This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Throughout much of human history, if there was meat on your table, odds were you'd had some kind of encounter with the creature who provided it before it was killed. You may have even experienced a relationship with that animal, or at least participated in an honoring ritual before slaughter. For most of us in America, that is far from the case today. On the flip side, there was a time when if animals were kept as pets, they were likely not considered part of the family. Today's guests have agreed to help us understand how our relationship with non-human creatures has changed over time. One traces some of that change back more than 2,000 years. The other has tracked a more recent revolution in what we might call the economics of pet care. By the way, how would you characterize the connection between humans and animals? Are there ethical, even religious factors involved? Your insight will be welcome, too, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. When it comes to connections between humans and animals, I suspect there is something of a continuum in public opinion. On one end might be those who say all creatures must be treated with compassion and respect, and we certainly should never house them in factory farms for slaughter. On the other end, all the hullabaloo about animal rights is just silly. Beasts were made for us to use as we please. Most of us probably fall somewhere in between, but this hour we'd like to hear your view. How much thought have you ever given to how animals are treated? Are some creatures more worthy of special consideration than others? How have our attitudes toward animals changed over time? We have two guests who can help us with those questions and more, but if you'd be willing to chip in too, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Cynthia Hurst is acting director of the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA, one of the first animal shelters in the country to develop a no-kill policy. Ms. Hurst, welcome back to the Insight Studios.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Athena Kirk has been using the topic of human-animal relations to get people thinking about classical literature. She is the Mellon Junior Fellow in Classics at Washington and Lee University, and she was recently honored by the Humane Society of the United States for a seminar she created called The Ancient Animal World. Dr. Kirk, thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Athena, you've been teaching your students that some present-day attitudes towards animals may have gotten started more than 2,000 years ago?
That's right. In the course that I taught this fall, one of the many things we were interested in was looking at classical literature and comparing the views that we saw in those groups of texts with how we feel today and the texts today that inform us about modern views about human-animal interactions. And one of the things that came out of our course and out of some of our readings was that there seemed to be more of a diversity in the ancient Greek world about views toward animals. You mentioned this continuum, and I think that is something that we see now, but we have seen a dominant view in the last few hundred years of humans generally using animals for their own purposes. And it's the view of several scholars that that is something that started with a group of philosophers in around the 3rd century BC and into the Roman period who took the ideas of Plato and Aristotle and sort of changed them around to make them into ideas that said that we could use animals for our own devices.
These were the Stoics?
Yeah, this is a group called the Stoics who have sort of a long history. It's not just one group of people at one time. And one of their main ways that they defended their views about animals was to use a particular word in Greek. The word in Greek for speech is the same as the word for reason. And so the Stoics said, well, animals don't have speech. That's not something that we share with them. Therefore, they also don't have reason. And if they don't have reason, then we are free not to have justice with them. We can treat them how we please.
Is that in any way similar to the idea of animals not having souls that was present and may still be present today in some Christian philosophies?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. It is something that the Stoics read into Aristotle's teaching about the soul, but he seems to have had a more complex idea of what animal souls were like. And Plato, before him, certainly seems to think that the transmigration of souls, so that is the reincarnation of a soul after death, could move between humans and animals. So yes, for the Stoics it does, but in the view of many scholars, this was a misreading that they had, an appropriation of Aristotle.
Cynthia Hurst from the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA, I would imagine that you run into a fair number of people who are absolutely certain that animals, at least their pets, can reason and definitely have souls.
Well, yes, we have people that we work with on all different sorts of levels who consider their pets to be part of the family, and they treat them as such. We've seen a lot of changes over the past years that we've operated, and one thing is that we tend to name our pets with human names.
And this is new.
It's fairly recent, yes. But we're seeing the trend that pets are seen more and more as part of the family. It's becoming more and more common for people to take them for regular checkups at the veterinarian, just as they do with members of the family who are human. And we spend more and more money on our pets than we used to. Last year, Americans spent $53 billion on pet food, vet care, and other services, such as grooming.
Say that again.
$53 billion, Tom.
With a B.
That's with a B.
And I understand that not only is it rare anymore for people to name their dog Spot or Rover, but the most popular name may actually come from vampire movies?
From the Twilight series. The most popular name for a dog and for a cat last year was Bella. So we're naming them more and more, you know, names like Charlie and Chloe and Louise and Lucy and so on. These are the names that we're naming our pets.
Well, to you listening, has there ever been a special animal in your life? Most of us are aware of the deep bond possible between an owner and their dog or cat, but how about some less common pets? Snakes, hamsters, rabbits, pot-bellied pigs. If you have anything to share about a profound connection you feel you once achieved with any sort of non-human animal, you're welcome to join the conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this from Carolyn on our Facebook page, who says, PETA and other organizations for animal rights are a result of the unpredictable changes in the world over the last 70 years or so. When my parents were young, everyone owned a few chickens. Everyone fished for their own Sunday suppers. They were connected to the animals, touched them when they were alive and when they were dead. Now pigs and cows are slaughtered by the billions, sight unseen, and fed to our dogs and cats. It's a bizarre turn of events. Athena Kirk, does that sound reminiscent of anything that you've been hearing from your students while you were teaching this course?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think it resonates with a lot of the issues that we were trying to bring up. I think Carolyn's quite right that a lot of how we interact with animals today has been quite recent. Certainly, there was a continuity, I think, over several hundreds of years that people did have much more interaction with animals than we have in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years. In ancient Greece, the time period and place that I study, everybody would have been familiar with cattle. They would have, known a lot more probably about animal husbandry, even on a sort of layperson's basis. And they would have also been involved with things like sacrifice and witnessed that sort of production of food in a way that we really don't today, unless we exist in very specialized circumstances. At the same time, and maybe this is something that Cynthia can speak to more, I think we are becoming very recently more aware of that gap. There's been a lot of work, I think, to make us re-understand our connection with those things.
Well, yes, definitely. Becoming a no-kill community for the Charlottesville-Albemarle area was very much a group effort between the city, the county, the SPCA, and all of the people in the community who support us, not only with their tax dollars, but with their individual donations. It was something that they really wanted to see happen because they have that connection to their own pets and they see that same connection they want to have with the community and all of the animals that live there. And it's something also that people look at when they're considering whether or not to move to an area now. They look at the school system, but they also look to see how the animals are treated in that area.
888-WMRA-TALK, the easy way to remember our phone number. Jay in Harrisonburg, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Real quick comment, real quick story. Years ago, I lived in Peru, and I was taking a walk in one of the cities in the highlands, and I was going across a bridge, and below was an open-air slaughterhouse. And all the cattle were alive and standing up, and I just thought that was curious and went on my way. Sometime later, I came back, and I had forgotten about it and looked down, and all there were piles of animal parts. I will never forget that as long as I live.
Did that influence in any way, Jay, how you feel about eating meat?
Yes, I don't eat that much anymore. I mean, those were large animals when I first was walking. When I came back, all there were parts. That was just, it's beyond words. I mean, I just...
Yeah, I think that's a very dramatic story, and thank you for sharing it. And I think it speaks a little bit to what we were saying, Cynthia and I, which is that it is something that can be very shocking when we don't have interaction with it on a day-to-day basis. As I was saying, this is something that would have been much more common, and I think for us to see something like that is extremely striking and very different. And at the same time, it's something that I think a lot of us feel we might benefit from understanding better and being more exposed to.
Jay, thank you so very much for your call. Do I understand correctly, Athena Kirk, that one of the things that you discovered in this look at ancient literature is that not only were people much more likely to have seen an animal alive before it was killed for meat, but also there often were kinds of rituals of even honoring ceremonies?
Yeah, very much so. The sacrifice, as you may or may not know, is a huge part of ancient Greek and Roman religion, and something that the entire community would have taken part in one way or another, not just people like priests and priestesses and temple officials, but really the whole gamut of everybody in the community would have been watching and maybe processing and in some way taking part in the ceremony to honor a god. Usually that's what the sacrifice would be for. And yet we do have evidence that there were certain measures in place that take us through both the killing of the animal and the ways in which that killing is ritualized and made to be very special and sacred and understood. So very, very much the opposite of what Jay was saying about his experience. There would even be sometimes measures in place to, you know, avert the animal's eyes from the altar or something like that, so that people understood that the animal might not know what was going to happen to it as a measure of compassion toward the creature.
Well, we don't deal so much with rituals or cows or that sort of thing, but certainly we have a different attitude towards whether or not we want to euthanize our dogs and our cats. And we want to make sure it's done in a very humane way. Even that has changed over time.
I understand that the standard by which some animal shelter can call itself a no-kill shelter is if at least 90% of the animals survive. Somewhere within that 10%, there may be animals who are so sick that they simply can't survive, and sometimes they are still euthanized.
Yes, a no-kill shelter, basically what it means, Tom, is that the animals are not euthanized for space. There's no such thing as not enough space. We figure out how to take care of them some other way. We might foster them out. We work really hard to promote them out in the community with all sorts of what we call off-site events at different locations so that people can come to a more easily accessible area to adopt them.
As you can hear by the music, we're going to hit the break in a second. So we'll continue our conversation. We are inviting you who are listening to share any thoughts you have about human-animal connections. And Sandra in Penn Laird will be next on the phone line when we get back.
Well, little lady, let me elucidate here. Everybody wants to be a cat, because a cat's the only cat who knows where it's at.
Tell me, everybody's picking up on that feline beat, because everything else is obsolete. A square with a horn makes you wish.
From the Disney film way back in the 1970s, The Aristocats. Cynthia Hurst, acting director of the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA, is one of our guests. Athena Kirk, Washington and Lee University's Mellon Junior Fellow of Classics, is the other. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We're talking about animal-human connections, and actually, I remember from, it might have been a year ago, when the fascinating historian from the engineering school at the University of Virginia, Peter Norton, who makes his occasional visits with us to tell us about his research on connections between culture and technology, he talked about the fact that 30 years before that Disney film was created, it could not have been created in our society, not because of the technology wasn't available, but because the attitude towards cats wasn't available. What Peter shared with us is that in the 1940s, after World War II ended, there was this thing that had been invented and used throughout the factories that were building up for the war in the U.S. called Fuller's Earth, that the federal government mandated all these factories have lots of to clean up spills and other environmental concerns. And then the war is over and there's not the need for it anymore. So the man who, I guess, invented Fuller's Earth, I think his name was Ed Lowe. He decided to create what became cat litter. And it started to take off in sales in the 1950s. And so people finally felt they could bring cats indoors where they lived outdoors before. And as a result of Fuller's Earth and cat litter, people started to have much more of a relationship with their cats.
Yes, they started to live indoors full time. Still, it's better for the cat and better for the birds, too, if the cat stays indoors. And cat litter makes that all possible. You're right.
So anything or everything to do with animals, human-animal connections, whether it has to do with technology or not, we'd be happy to hear your observations at 888-WMRA-TALK. Sandra in Penn-Laird, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. I think that when we talk about animal welfare or animal rights, I prefer to call it animal welfare. Our scope of thinking is the domestic pet more than it is the animal that we eat. The animal that we eat has now become, it always was a product in a way of agriculture, but now it really is just an inanimate cog product that is given absolutely no concern whatsoever. And people who don't care for animals or just plain don't like them see this as a very silly issue to even bring up. But we all need to remember that because of human selfishness in wanting to eat meat three times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which was just unheard of 30 or 40 years ago and probably doesn't exist anywhere else in the world except in America. I don't think anybody else eats meat three times a day, any other culture or society. Those animals that we are causing to reproduce and be raised and slaughtered then industrially are actually producing an enormous amount of poison for us. But we don't want to think about that. Years and years ago, when we were so afraid of nuclear war and the nuclear winter, there was a meeting of scientists who were going to discuss what are we going to do when the nuclear winter comes. One scientist stood up and said, "Gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that I think a much greater threat to us is manure, and we really need to be talking about that." Well, we certainly are talking about it now, and it's almost too late. We have killed so many of our water supplies, contaminated them. We have eaten the medicines, the antibiotics, and so forth that are given to these animals to keep them alive and reasonably healthy in terribly overcrowded conditions.
Sandra, hold on just a second. I want to see if our guests have any response. Obviously, some strong opinion there. Athena Kirk, I wouldn't be surprised if in the discussions in your classroom you had similar strong opinions.
Yeah, I'm very glad that you bring this issue up, Sandra, because it is something that I think people are becoming more aware of. But you're right, it's not something that we tend to think about or we have thought about, and it is a big change. In my course, I was very interested in my students being college students, first of all, becoming aware of some of these things through reading the work of people like Michael Pollan, who have done a very good job of publicizing these sorts of issues in an accessible, but also I think in a very thoughtful and intellectually provoking way. So for the students, I think it was very important for me to expose them to a lot of those issues, as well as to teach them about a little bit more of the backstory behind this. Because I think one of the most important things that we can do is be as aware as possible so that we can continue to make as informed decisions as possible. One of the important things I think for me that I wanted to impart to them was that you can't change everything overnight, and a lot of us aren't comfortable changing our behaviors overnight, even though they may have come to a problematic and unsustainable place. What I think is very important is to really think about why it is that you make the choices that you do with the amount of meat that you eat, say, or where you buy your meat or from whom you procure it. So those are some of the issues that I think are very important for us to keep on having a dialogue about and continuing to talk about. I think it's also important that you brought up this issue of animal welfare versus animal rights, because I think that's also an important distinction to make. It's better, I think, I agree, to talk about animal welfare because it allows us to rethink these issues and not just come up with a blanket, you know, rule that we can apply to all of our interactions and all of our choices, but rather to treat animal welfare on a case-by-case kind of basis.
Sandra, thank you again for your call. Cynthia Hurst from the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA. It's my understanding that your organization has noticed a phenomenon, having gone to a no-kill policy, that results in far more people coming to visit you and end up adopting pets. And that seems almost ironic to me, but you've got an explanation.
Well, and this may be anecdotal, but we do find that people are a little more comfortable coming in when they realize that all of the animals that they're seeing will eventually be adopted out. There is definitely a stronger connection, at least among what we call companion animals now, perhaps different than what Athena was just addressing with Sandra. We find that people are more and more connected with their companion animals, and perhaps that will eventually spill over into how we're looking at the animals that we're eating as well.
Do I understand that the part of what's going on is that people walk through the doors of an SPCA and now in Charlottesville not being overwhelmed with potential guilt? The idea being that if I don't take that animal home with me, there is a good chance that it's going to be euthanized. It's going to be killed if it doesn't get adopted soon. Taken that away, people no longer have to worry about that guilt when they walk through your doors, so they're more willing to come in?
I believe so. I think that it also has a better atmosphere for everyone that's coming in, whether they're volunteering or working there. Just the whole positivity of knowing that we're helping every single animal that we can, regardless of the amount of space that we may have for it. And, of course, we treat them all medically. We have a full-time veterinarian as well as two part-time veterinarians who take care of the animals who are sick. But just as many owners have to sometimes make that difficult decision not to keep an animal any longer, but to let it move on, With euthanasia, we do the same occasionally with the animals that we have too.
Does that say something, though, about how much we as humans don't like to think about animals being quote unquote put down? Whether we're looking back at Sandra's concerns about, in essence, factory farming and where our meat comes from, or concern about whether animals in the shelter, and most shelters still do have policies where after a certain period of time, they will euthanize the animals who are not adopted, that we operate sort of on a turn our face away from what might happen to these creatures philosophy.
I think that's quite possible. I mean, to me, coming from a sort of more philosophical perspective sometimes, I guess, this has to do with our own struggle to identify what it is that makes us human and separates us from those creatures.
And is it possible in ancient times when people knew that the creatures that they were raising were going to end up being slaughtered and used for food, that the need to turn away wasn't as pronounced? It seems to me one of the things that I heard, Athena, in preparing for the show was from a veterinarian who works in our region who said, you know, when vet students come here who are in an internship and they come from a rural area and they have a farming background, all of the controversy about animals being killed seems silly to them because they know that's what happens. They raise animals and eventually they're killed for food. But people who come from urban areas where the whole idea of a steak dinner comes simply from something that you picked up at the grocery store, they seem to have a lot more difficulty with it.
Yeah, I think there could be a way in which an ancient audience, you know, aligning more with that rural group of people could be more inured to that sort of thing. But that's not to say that they didn't have a lot of compassion for animal suffering. There were ancient vegetarians and very vocal ones.
Really?
You know, certainly so. One of the ones that we hear the most from is the philosopher about vegetarianism is the philosopher or the writer Plutarch, as well as another writer named Porphyry, who has an entire treatise on why we should abstain from animal flesh. It makes us bad philosophers because we spend too much of our energy trying to digest it. But I think you're quite right that there is a contrast between the urban and the rural perspective. But that's not to say there wasn't some feeling of compassion in antiquity as well.
Athena Kirk is the Mellon Jr. Fellow in the Classics Department at Washington and Lee University. She was recently honored by the Humane Society of the United States for a seminar she created called The Ancient Animal World. Cynthia Hurst worked for many years as a kind of independent contractor, helping a variety of nonprofits improve their organizations. Today, she serves as acting director of a no-kill animal shelter, the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Human-animal connections, our focus. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Andrew in San Francisco, thanks for calling in.
Hi, I have a question for the professor. I was wondering if we have any stories from the ancient world in which an animal life was praised or valued or even chosen over a human life. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
That's a great question. Thank you for asking it. Trying to think of an example of that coming to mind off the top of my head. You know, certainly there were some proponents of animalism in the ancient world. That's the idea that animals are either just as important or more important than us.
Well, you mentioned earlier about Plato believing in transmigration. Is that what it's called?
That's right.
And that, in essence, means that he believed in some form of reincarnation and that the human soul, after a human being died, might end up in an animal?
Right, that's right. We do think that is a possibility that Plato had in mind, which brings us to the conclusion that there is some equality on the part of humans and animals, right? That there isn't such an incredibly great divide. You know, one story where I can't say that an animal life is necessarily being elevated over a human life, but one where it's being taken very seriously, and it's sort of reminds me of the topic we were just addressing with euthanasia and witnessing deaths of things like pets is from the Odyssey. There's a relatively famous scene toward the end when Odysseus has been away for years and years, and he finally comes home, but he's in disguise, so nobody recognizes him yet. But the one being that does recognize him is his old dog, who he trained when he was young, and the dog is now old, kind of decrepit, and fallen on hard times. So the dog runs up to Odysseus. Well, he can't really run. He's not in very good shape, but he recognizes Odysseus. He's so happy to see his master that he wags his tail, and it's this very touching moment because the dog immediately dies after he sees him. And it's one of the moments in which Odysseus and the audience, I think, as well, feels this, you know, real pathos of the relationship that humans and animals can have, and the idea that you can go home and see somebody who's just as important to you as one of your human family members.
You got a big smile on your face, so I wondered if that meant you had a story to tell.
Well, I was thinking about sort of the other way around, and we keep talking about how we take care of animals and what we do for them, but we haven't really touched a whole lot, except for maybe that little story on what they do for us. We know scientific studies have shown that they can help lower our blood pressure, reduce stress, and even prevent heart disease and fight depression. And I was just thinking about this woman the other day who came to the SPCA. She was standing outside. She had a beagle on a leash. And I asked her if she was considering adopting the beagle. And she said, well, yes, her husband had just passed away in November, and he had a protracted illness for 3 years, and during that time they had to put their dog down, but she couldn't get another because it was just too much to take care of both. But now she was really looking forward to the companionship, and so we were able to hook her up with our Seniors for Seniors program, where you can adopt a senior pet if you're 60 or over, and the animal's 7 years or more. For free. And so that's a great way that we can reach out and help animals help people. And it's not just always the other around. I think everybody has a story of when an animal consoled them or made them happy or wagged their tail when they got home and made them feel more important than anyone else.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you again for your call. To you who are listening, have you ever come across an animal-related story in literature that gave you pause? Have you ever come across a person whose attitude towards animals was so completely different from your own that it may have prompted you to rethink some things? 888-WMRA-TALK. Easy way to remember our phone number. And all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Next to Lexington, Mohammed, thanks for calling in. Your question, your comment, please.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I enjoy this show every day.
Thank you.
And, forgive me in advance if this issue has already been addressed, but I'm calling to make, it's more of a comment than a question. My observation is that the way we feel about slaughtering or not slaughtering an animal depends naturally on the degree of our intimacy with that animal. I grew up in West Africa in an environment where chickens, goats, and sheep were raised.
Mohammed, I think you may have a story for us, and we're going to hit the break here in just a few moments. So I'm hoping you can hang on, and we'll hear that story when we get back.
No problem.
We're going to continue here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 60 seconds.
Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O, and on that farm he had a sheep, E-I-E-I-O, with a ba-ba here and a ba-ba there, here a ba, there a ba, everywhere a ba-ba. Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O.
Who Who says you can't have fun when you're talking about serious subjects like human-animal connections? That was Max and Millie from their cassette of animal songs, the very recognizable Old MacDonald. Our phone number we think you may have heard during the break, but let me repeat, is 888-WMRA-TALK. If you have any thoughts to share or questions for our guest, Cynthia Hurst, acting director of the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA, Athena Kirk, Washington and Lee University Mellon Junior Fellow of Classics. And here on the phone line with us in Lexington, Mohammed, you have a story about a pet chicken, do I understand, Mohammed?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
Go ahead.
Yes, so I developed a relationship with this chicken that I had once. As a kid, I was asked often to slaughter the chicken that was supposed to be eaten for the meal for the day. It was easy for me to do. But I adopted this chicken as a pet, and when it came to eating the chicken, I just refused to have the chicken slaughtered because I developed a special relationship with it. So that taught me an important lesson that the way we feel about slaughtering an animal or refusing to slaughter it comes down to the degree of the intimacy we develop with that animal over a certain period of time. So I just wanted to share that experience with you guys.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Mohammed. It is definitely something I think that we see in a personal way. You know, you do develop a relationship, and we also see that in, I think, a wider social way, even if it's not on an individual basis, like the story that you described with your chicken. So, you know, this is one reason that there are a lot of animals that as a breed or a species we consider as pet animals and really don't feel comfortable eating, even if it weren't, you know, our own pet. So dogs and cats, I think, of course, we generally tend to feel this way about. But throughout history, for the Greeks, for example, animals like horses and donkeys and mules, even though they didn't keep them as pets in the same way we might think about dogs or cats, they were socialized and they were so much a part of their social and kind of their lives in terms of things like competitions and athletics, that they were animals that they didn't eat either. This is something that's been in the news lately, right? Cultures that do and do not eat horses. And this is something that seems to be a broad cultural taboo. If you do feel like not only your person, but your culture has a relationship with a certain kind of animal, it's very difficult to eat it.
See, I see the big smile on your face and I figure you're going to say something. So I'm just... waiting.
Well, I can certainly see that would be the case. Athena's right. We are not dealing with eating dogs and cats versus what we generally have. I was thinking actually about what I had read in a book recently about our domestication of horses and how we used to eat horses, you know, centuries ago, but we no longer do that. So I think our attitudes change over time, and certainly that's what's been happening with our views of all sorts of animals, including dogs and cats.
Mohammed, do you recall how old you were when this incident took place?
Oh, I was around about 12 years old.
And did you have a name for your pet chicken?
Yes, I call it Ringo.
And did you have names for the other chickens, the ones that you did kill?
No, that was the only chicken. That was the only one. And the other chickens, they were fine with me, you know, fine for dinner. But that particular one, I just refused to have it.
Do you recall way back at the age of 12 what it was about Ringo, what it was about this particular chicken that made it possible for you to establish this bond, this connection?
It's a very interesting question. I cannot remember for the life of me why. There was just something about the chicken that attracted me to her, and then I just decided to develop this relationship and gave it a name and fed it separately and took it with me pretty much wherever I went, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Mohammed, thank you so very much for sharing that perspective and that story with us.
All right, thank you very much for the show.
We have here on the WMRA Virginia Insight Facebook page from, if I'm mispronouncing your name, I apologize, but I think it might be Tipopal, who says, my sophomore year at Northern Illinois University back in the early 70s was made better because I took my two dogs to all my classes. During class, they laid down on either side of my chair and rested after running and playing on the way to class. All my professors welcomed them as they were so well behaved. Last week, as I was listening to a program on babies and their development on WMRA, they talked about talking to your babies, which helps in their development. I realized that I had done the same thing with my dogs and that their recognition of words was quite large, ranging from, do you want to go for a ride, to bring me the Frisbee.
Well, we certainly develop these connections with our companion animals, and we hear about this sort of thing on a regular basis. You see people on television shows with their dogs who can do all sorts of tricks and all sorts of words that they can respond to. And, you know, as he was just talking about with his pet chicken, people get attached to a particular animal. We got in about almost 3,600 animals last year at the Charlottesville Almira SPCA, and 600 of those got returned to their owners because people just keep looking for that particular pet that they have a connection to. We had one couple that just kept coming in every week to look for this cat, and finally it showed up. And we were able to call them and let them know that it was there, and they were so excited. And no other cat would do, and I think any of us that has a companion animal certainly understands that. We don't see them as, any cat will do or any dog will do. We have a definite connection with particular animals, and there's nothing quite so special as that bond.
Athena Kirk from Washington and Lee University, you talked early in the hour about this group in ancient Greece, I guess dating back as far as 2,300 years ago, called the Stoics, who may have been the first in that society to develop the idea or push the idea that since animals couldn't speak, they couldn't reason, they didn't have to be treated as anything other than beasts. I'm curious if you have any sense of whether there was something behind the desire to push for that philosophical shift. Sometimes there are economic reasons. If all of a sudden a society or some portion of a society wants there to be more slaughter of animals for food or something else going on, was there something behind that philosophical shift that you're aware of, or did it just kind of evolve?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's one to which I can't give a direct answer of one particular reason. It is something that I think evolved, and what I think maybe is an easier way to explain that story is that it continued to get, that one piece of it continued to get picked up. You can think of it a little like evolution, where you start out with a lot of different kind of versions of something and you streamline, right? We have the survival of the fittest. And I think for a long time, it was very beneficial to many different people at many different moments to continue that sort of narrative, to say, well, it would be beneficial to me to think for the moment that this animal can't reason, so therefore I can use it, I can pack all of my things onto it, or I can kill it and eat it because I'd like to. So I think more so than there being one direct person that was responsible for pushing this particular agenda for a certain reason, it was something that kept on getting continued because it was beneficial in many different ways, and it was appealing to people. So one of the ways that it seems to get taken through is through the Christian era as well, in which someone like Augustine recognizes, you know, that we see beasts suffering, but says, but at the same time, they don't have the same kind of reason as we do. They're not involved in the same sorts of spiritual stakes as we are, so we can continue to use them for a kind of religious argument like that and a religious philosopher like that. It would mean something very different to put us on more equal terms with animals.
The philosophy of human-animal relations might be one way to title this hour's conversation. We've been hearing that changes in philosophical beliefs have influenced societal attitudes towards animals over long periods of time. So I'm curious, to you who are listening, have you noticed changes in attitudes towards animals in your very own lifetime. We've got just a couple more minutes to take calls, but if you want to share your thoughts, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Cynthia Hurst from the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA. As much as we've been focusing on not mistreating animals and the kind of loveliness that can occur in a bond between humans and animals, sometimes there's sort of the flip side of this that looks a little ridiculous, at least to some of us. And it's my understanding that you found some things about how much people are spending on pets in a way that might look frivolous, like, I don't know, Halloween costumes?
Yes. In 2010, Americans spent $70 million on Halloween costumes for their pets. And in 2011, they spent $370 million on Halloween costumes for their pets. But I figure, you know, it's their money. They can do with it as they please. And it's not really harming anyone. And perhaps it helped boost the economy a little bit, which we could always use right now.
I'm just thinking about if you've got that kind of money to spend, if spending it on Pooch, who is no longer named Pooch, I guess he's now named George, is a wise choice. But it does seem to those of us who are not directly in the family at times that some people have a bizarre degree of attachment to their pets.
Well, a lot of Americans live alone, and that pet may be the only other being that they're sharing space with at home. So I can certainly understand why that might happen sometimes, and I'm not going to judge. We all have to choose how we're going to spend our money. I'd certainly rather see it spent that way than some other ways that people could spend it that might not be as positive. Of course, if they would prefer to send their money to the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA, that would be great too. We totally rely on donations from the community to keep the work that we're doing going.
I certainly agree with you, and I'm glad that we brought some of this up, although I will add that the only time that I ever saw my family's terrier so unhappy, he's a very docile and happy dog, was when he was dressed up as a moose for Halloween. I don't think this actually counts as real cruelty, but that dog was in no shape to go outside and revel with the rest of the trick-or-treaters. But if that's the worst that comes of Halloween costumes, I think maybe we're okay on that particular front. We have bigger fish to fry, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. That's right, Athena.
Where did you end up with this course that you taught? And why do you think the Humane Society of the United States was so impressed that it wanted to help pay for it?
Well, I'll answer the first question first. Where we ended up was in a place of thinking about animal ethics. I think we started out thinking about the many ways in which the ancient world had of grappling with the human-animal relationship. So grappling with the idea of what is it that makes us human and not these animals? What is the hierarchy of beings? Is it us versus them, or are we on a continuum with plants and with gods? So those are some questions that we started out thinking about, reading things from things as diverse as animal narrators, so stories in which an animal is actually telling the story, to some of the more philosophical texts that I've been talking about earlier in the hour. And where we ended up was really looking at some of these modern writers who are questioning some of these things, the issues that we've been thinking about factory farming, about how we treat our pets, about how we treat chickens, broiler chickens, other, you know, maybe more smaller concerns that we don't always think about, cockfighting, but things that are very of great concern to the animal welfare world. So I surmise, I suppose, without having directly spoken to them about this, that the Humane Society was interested in that sort of connection, in talking about these ancient texts and their relevance to how we think about these very pressing issues now. And to me, I think it was very important to show the students that we can think about some very relevant, modern, current issues with reference to these very important and not irrelevant at all texts, and use those two sides to really inform one another. So there's a reason to read, for example, there's a Roman novel called The Golden Ass about a man who accidentally turns himself into a donkey. And we read that, you know, it's a fun kind of fantastical story. But we also read it alongside Black Beauty, which we probably all know as a 19th century story about a horse that actually changed a lot of the ways that we treated our horses. And so reading those two things together, I think, was really eye-opening to the students and to me.
Also getting students interested in the idea that they can look back at societies and their literature over thousands of years and see something worthwhile.
That's right. Absolutely. That's always one of the major goals of us in the classics.
Well, this has certainly been a worthwhile hour. Our guests have been Athena Kirk, the Mellon Junior Fellow of Classics at Washington and Lee University, as well as Cynthia Hurst, Acting Director of the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA. Thank you both so much for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Virginia Insight's executive producers Matt Bingay, our associate producers Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find more information about each of our guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.